A few months ago, I received an invitation to a special birthday party for a dear friend of many decades, a lady some of you may know personally, Bobby Geismar, Barbara Peck Geismar, Mrs. Alan S. Geismar of Shaker Heights. I was hoping that she could come tonight, but she could not. But with her kind permission, I would like to show you how the little piece that I wrote in her honor was made, what the creative process was that brought it to life. I began by asking myself, is her name adaptable to a musical shape? And I calculated the available letters. Barbara Geismar. Oops. All right, B is D, A is A, right. D is B flat, that's no problem. B is B, A. B, G. R, what do we do without? Well, do, re, mi, to D. No problem. Re, do, re, mi. All right, but then we find to our shock that it repeats. Bar, bar. Is that a problem? Maybe not. Well, now, this is an artificial way of doing things, but it's possible. There's no problem. Now, the last name, there's a bar, bar, there's an A missing. All right, we have an A, but we've already been down there. We don't want to repeat that. Let's get boring. Why not go in the upper A? Okay. Then you go on, G, E, what do we do with an I? There's nothing we can do with an I. There's no such musical note. So we leave it out. And then we go to the letter M. What do we do with M? Aha, do, re, mi. It's an E. No problem. But then comes an S. What do we do with an S? Well, it's the same thing that Shostakovich did. It's an E flat. The German word is S. S dur means E flat. E. All right. Then, unfortunately, you have to go back to the E. That's not so good. Then what do we do? And then, to our horror, we discover that we have another E. Now, can we go down? And then, a final R or D? Okay, so this is how these notes go. It makes it a rather peculiar, makes a peculiar theme, doesn't it? It doesn't quite work until you begin to make a rhythm. Now it's beginning to have a little bit of a shape. Finally, on the pencil, you begin to sketch the darn thing, and you discover that you have to have some harmonies. So what the fingers automatically go... Okay, so far, now what do you do with that? This is the problem. Change the register. And instead of just being bum bum bum, do. Open it up so that you have a different rhythm. Then you find that you want to repeat the original theme. But we've already done that.
that isn't so good. So why not hold the left hand in the throat? And then you're going to do it with this down maybe, which you've done before. Why not give it a totally different tone color? And then you have an ending, which you want to have D and D, G and D, G and D, D, G, whatever order. So my first thought was, so finally, this is the way the whole thing got put together very fast. This couldn't take half the time that I'm telling you this. And here is my non-professional attempt to tell you the whole piece. What has happened, which is essential to the composition of any piece, large or small, these thought processes, which I tried to put in words for you, are not spelled out that way in composing. They happen subconsciously and very quickly. This mixture of instant self-criticism in how a phrase can be improved to say within this given space what it needs to do. This self-criticism is of extreme importance. At every step, a composer will say to himself, this works or this doesn't work. This doesn't yet work. Here I have to do something. This is nice. No, this is not nice. Now I've got it. Now, if the poet, for example, has a rhyme scheme to which he wishes to adhere, or a metrical scheme like the iambic pentameter of Shakespeare, then he's made for himself an obstacle to overcome, a hurdle to jump over. If everything is allowed him, if everything is possible, the challenge is lessened, the sense of overcoming diminished. Stravinsky always said that he needed a foil, an obstacle to work against. Only then did the task begin to intrigue him. So when a composer works with a limited number of musical notes out of which he must construct a piece, he will enjoy these self-imposed limits and not try to cheat by putting in notes that don't belong just because it would make the task easier. That's intellectually would be dishonest. So this constant process of criticizing the product as you make it, and not just later, is a major part of the act of composition, of creating the piece of music. The most famous example, perhaps, in musical history is a look into the composer's workshop made possible by the fact that Beethoven's sketches are available to us. Now, this theme you all know. This is the beginning of the andante of the fifth symphony. Come to him like Athena leaping from the head of Zeus. But is that what happened? Not at all. What happened was this. Beethoven's first idea, believe it or not, sounded like this. For years and didn't really finish it until such a time when he said, all right, here I've really got it. And of course what we finally have after that most unpromising beginning is this. Came about. Beethoven had these conversation books in which he conversed with people. He was deaf and people would write out questions to him. And there was one man by the name of Louis Schlösser who, just a few years before Beethoven's death, seemed to have written down what the great man answered. And this is the famous statement that proves exactly what we have been showing. Beethoven said, I carry my thoughts about with me for a long time, often for a very long time, before writing them down. I can rely on my memory for this and can be sure that once I have grasped the theme, I shall not forget it, even years later. I change many things, discard others, and try again and again until I'm satisfied. Then, in my head, I begin to elaborate the work in its breadth, its narrowness, its height, its depth, and since I'm aware of what I want to do, the underlying idea never deserts me. It rises, it grows. I hear and see the image in front of me from every angle as if it had been cast in sculpture, and only the labor of writing it down remains, a labor which need not take long, but varies according to the time at my disposal, since I very often work on several things at the same time. Yet I can always be sure that I shall not confuse one with the other. This process that I've described here is a little bit like pottery. My mother was a wonderful ceramic artist, and I've seen her try to build up a vase, then squash, down it goes. Up it comes again. Down, still no good. Third, fourth. Maybe the fifth time. Ah, yes, this is what I can work with. But the point is that she had the concept of what she wanted to make in her head. And the material then had to meet that criteria. Exactly the same with Beethoven. The theme as we now know it must have been in his subconscious that it needed work to get there. Beethoven continues, you may ask me where I obtain my ideas. I cannot answer this with any certainty. They come unbidden, spontaneously or unspontaneously. I may grasp them with my hands in the open air while walking in the woods, in the stillness of night and early morning. Stimulated by these moods which poets turn into words, I turn my ideas into tones which resound or roar and rage until at last they stand before me in the form of notes. Schumann seemed to be contradicting Beethoven's view of composing when he says, the first concept is always the best and most natural. The intellect can err, the sentiment never. Now this is a very romantic view, which is not borne out even by Schumann's own works, where he often completely revised major works like the Fourth Symphony. He would have insisted that composing is feeling in tones, while Beethoven was quoted to say that composition was thinking in tones. And now we, in this gathering, have to ask ourselves, to what extent does this process reflect the deep inner processes of the psyche? What does it tell us about our subtle inner life, our subconscious, our unconscious? Frankly, I don't know. I tend to believe for the most part it is not an issue of self-expression, of releasing deep psychic forces from within us, but of simple aesthetics. As I said, Susanne Langer said that an artist is not so much concerned with expressing himself or herself, but with finding a significant form. The artist wants to say what he or she had to say in the most artistically satisfying manner possible. And it is understood that in this process, all the artist's deep psychological energies will be somehow mysteriously involved. But exactly how remains a mystery. Why and how could an artist produce a cheerful composition while feeling horribly out of sorts, as Tchaikovsky once said? Or the exact opposite, like producing the Pathetique Symphony while he was feeling just fine? The answer is surprising and quite simple. It isn't possible for a composer, perhaps different from the situation of a painter, to sustain a specific mood during the entire process of notating his work. What he really does, as every composer from Tchaikovsky to Hindemith has confirmed, is to remember the mood that he has experienced or wishes to capture. As Wordsworth put it, poetry is emotion recollected in tranquility, or at least long after the initial stimulus, whether emotional or aesthetic. For one of his most inspired poems, Dylan Thomas made 200 drafts of version. The poem is Fern Hill. And it is said that when he was dissatisfied with anything, he would tear it all up and start over from the beginning in order to capture the flow and the progression. Composers tell you that if they must stop somewhere while working, they have got to go back to the beginning, or at least an earlier place, to reestablish the logic of the progression. In all of this process, it's the old funny saying of 10% inspiration and 90% perspiration. Composing, painting, writing a poem is work. It's not accidentally that we call an artistic creation a work. Aaron Copland was once asked whether he waited for inspiration. Every day, he answered. And what do you do while you work, while you wait, said the student. I work, said Paul. There are constant and thousands of comments about how this works, because it is work. The stimulus may indeed involve the composer emotionally, but as Richard Strauss, the most realistic of creative artists, once said, I am never feverishly excited. Music is difficult to handle. One must be cool and collected when writing it down. The head which invented Tristan and Isolde had to be as cool as marble. Few concepts are so misunderstood in music as emotion. Wagner, to whom Strauss just referred, put it this way. What music expresses is eternal, infinite, and ideal. It does not express the passion, love, or longing of such and such an individual on such and such an occasion. But passion, love, and longing in itself. And this it presents in that unlimited variety of motivations which is the exclusive and particular characteristic of music, foreign and inexpressible in any other language. The distinguished composer, American composer Roger Sessions, sets us right in a wonderful paragraph. Emotion is specific, individual, and conscious. Music goes deeper than that, to the energies which animate our psychic life, and out of these creates a pattern which has an existent laws and human significance of its own. It reproduces for us the most intimate essence, the tempo and the energy of our spiritual being, our tranquility, our restlessness, our animation, our discouragement, our vitality, and our weaknesses, all in fact are the fine shades of dynamic variations of our inner life. It represents these far more directly and specifically than is possible through any other medium of human communication. And this, of course, is also the reason why these various moods can follow so rapidly upon each other. I mean, if you are at a funeral and you're feeling in a funereal mood, a very funny situation isn't going to send you into gales of laughter. In music, you can do that because these are shadows of the real thing. There may be an artistic reason for these sudden juxtapositions, as we so often find them in the music of Mahler. So what does it all mean? Here is Mendelssohn on the subject. Mendelssohn, who wrote so much wonderful pictorial music, like the beautiful Melusina, the Hebrides Overture, the Italian Symphony, the Scottish Symphony, whatever. Mendelssohn said, there's so much talk about music and yet so little is said. For my part, I believe that words do not suffice for such a purpose, and if I found they did suffice, I would finally have nothing more to do with music. People often claim that music is too ambiguous, that what they should be thinking as they listen is unclear, whereas everyone understands words. With me, it is exactly the reverse. The thoughts that are expressed to me by music that I love are not too indefinite to be put into words, but too definite. The poet John Ciardi, longtime poetry editor of the late and lamented Saturday Review of Literature, wrote an essay in the 1950s which has been a lodestone for me and for many others. It was entitled, How Does a Poem Mean? How does a poem mean? The title stops you cold. Yes, before a poem can mean anything, it must have the means to do so. Before the why comes the how. And if they can appear almost simultaneously, so much the better. But as we have seen, the so-called inspiration is not destroyed by the work, the technique, the craft. It is the technique and the craft which make possible the just and effective shape of the poem, or the picture, or the piece of music. They bring to life what it is the artist's wish to say. And if he says it well, then the meaning will become clear. If he says it badly or awkwardly, the meaning may be obscured or damaged, if you will. Schubert was the most spontaneous of composers, like Mozart. He almost never sketched. But even he was capable of the most extraordinary revisions. Listen to this famous theme. Thank you. Grand Symphony, right? The C major symphony. Yum pa pum pa pum pa pum pa pum. Yum pa pum pa pum pa pum pa pum. Wonderful. It couldn't be anything else. The fact is that Schubert had completely finished the first movement in clean score, in which that theme went not before he discovered that that didn't work. And in the clean score, which exists, you can see scratched out hundreds of times that second note. So instead of yum pa pum pa pum, it's yum pa pum pa pum pa pum pa pum, which makes all the difference in the world. The great English musician, conductor, and critic Donald Francis Toby, who is the patron saint of all modern program annotators, once said, "Inspiration is akin to first-rate athletic form. If a composer is not ready to deal with the material that has occurred to him, it may simply be lost or wasted. The problem for any artist is always the same. Here is the idea. How do I realize it? How do I go on? What comes next and why? Let me show you how this urge not to do the symmetrical thing, to choose the easy way, works with a master like Joseph Haydn. Here is the Allegro scene from his Symphony No. 50. Introductory chords, and then the theme. Obviously, he's gone, he's stayed in C. Bum, tonic key. Okay, the normal course in classical music is that he would now turn to the dominant. How about this? Now, if he had done that, we wouldn't give it a second thought. But perhaps then he wouldn't be Haydn. A minor master of the 18th century might have answered that way. This is what Haydn does. Hang on to that. But he does it by reversing the direction. It's like a bird taking off. Incredible.
Thank you.
that's what divides the talent from the genius. Now, a great deal of music that exists is emotion neutral. It says exactly what it wants to say, and it means exactly what it says, no more. Take a Vivaldi concerto for violin. It may be humdrum, it may be nearly mechanical, written in a tremendous rush while half asleep, or it may be a transcendent masterpiece like the four violin concertos in The Seasons. And even though the latter works have stories or images attached to them in the form of sonnets from Vivaldi's own pen, we don't need to associate the music constantly with the words. The concertos can be heard as non-programmatic, emotion-neutral music, as what we used to call absolute music, like a Bach fugue or a Chopin etude. But of course, there are cases when we cannot fail to hear an anguished voice, the composer going beyond the objective shaping of an artwork by transforming into sound a deeply personal experience. The symphonies of Gustav Mahler, for example, are filled with such examples. And perhaps most daringly, in a really avant-garde way, in his final uncompleted work, The Tenth Symphony. In the first movement, which is for the most part a searingly beautiful adagio, he comes to a place which you may interpret psychologically as you wish. I don't dare do it myself. James Levine conducting the Philadelphia Orchestra. Incredible chord structure. This is 1910, 3 years before the writer Spring came out. A hyper-modern moment in the music of Mahler. And in the sketches for the last movement of the symphony, written during a tremendous crisis in his married life, yes, less than a year before his death, there are strange and hysterical outcries on the pages, in words, not in music, with the word farewell repeated over and over again. Another such cataclysmic moment, our last musical example, occurs in Schubert's great C major symphony, of which we have already played the first movement, this piece justifiably called the Great C Major. Now, in this passage from the second movement, the music finds itself facing an abyss into which, very much like the Mahler, it falls with shattering realism. A crime to stop at that point. He noticed how after that long pause, how painful was the slow climb upward, the recovery of self and of equilibrium, and how movingly it was mirrored in the phrases of the cellos. You heard the Cleveland Orchestra conducted by George Sell around 1957. Now, what you've been so patiently listening to is something that grew like topsy. We could go on for hours with important insights from this source and that. You will be relieved to hear that I won't subject you to that. But after those two shattering examples from Mahler and Schubert, I would like to end with some comparatively good cheer. A brief song cycle on a psychoanalytic subject. It is one I wrote almost 20 years ago, but it had its first performance only in 1991. The texts are being handed out to you at this time. Called Post-Session Replays, they were written by my sister-in-law, Carol Burdick, a poet and teacher of literature at Alfred University in upstate New York. These poems are, one might say, tragicomic in intent. You will be familiar with the sentiments expressed. I draw your attention to a few details. Each song is preceded and, except for the last, followed by a quizzical phrase on the piano, one that leaves things very much unresolved. Then comes a two-chord motif, different for each song, that sets the scene. In song number 4, Pity 'Tis True, you will suddenly hear someone's pocket alarm going off. The perpetrator couldn't find it for a while to turn it off, and the performers very appropriately went along with a tick, tick, tick of the gadget. In number 5, Napoleonis, you will discern in the proper key of E-flat major the reference to the main theme of Beethoven's Eroica, of course originally dedicated to Napoleon. And in the 8th song, Boundary Marker, the patient is clearly distraught, while the piano part, perhaps representing the therapist, remains unflappably cool and collected. Now here is that first performance, marvelously delivered at the Cleveland Institute of Music in February of 1991 by tenor Wills Morgan, an exceptionally gifted black singer from England, with Zoe Solomon, also from England, a very gifted artist, at the piano.
Expensive moments of my life. Thank you.
So much for your kind attention, and if your energy level is still up for some questions, I would be happy to try to answer them. Anybody bothered by any part of this disquisition? Don't tell me we've answered all problems and questions. It can't be done.
Yes, sir. I have one comment.
Please. I'm with you all the way. I think it is extremely important. I was astonished to find just about a year or two ago that the word sublimation in chemistry means something totally different. Can someone enlighten us?
Turning liquids into gases.
Solid into gases. That's called sublimation. That's not what you mean, I'm sure. Although a certain amount of hot air may be involved.
I think your quote from Sessions actually conveys a good deal of sublimation.
Exactly. exactly. The wonderful book from the composer, performer, listener is the book by Sessions. It's a wonderful little book, full of wisdom. Anything else? Yes, sir.
Do you think music speaks to people in the way you said, and that it seems to speak more directly to a wordless part of them? Because the human mind loves patterns, like the sea patterns in the world. And music is the ultimate string of patterns.
I think you are absolutely right. That's what is meant in various people talking about abstraction. It is a question of pattern making. The question and answer design, for example, of so much music. When Schubert goes, yum, ba-dum, 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 yum, ba-dum, 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 this is question and answer. These are patterns that reach you at once, like as if they were speaking. Now, there is a lot of discussion whether music is a language, another kind of language. I don't know, but it certainly is a communication on a level that goes a great deal deeper than words can. It goes to essentials, just as you said. And if you are responsive to music, you will respond to a music. For example, why does a certain modulation in Schubert make us cry? I mean, I find tears coming to my eyes at certain places in the C major string quintet. It just reaches me like nothing else. Why? I don't know. There is something in the Friedrich Emanuel Bach, the oldest son, Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach, the oldest of Bach's sons, once said, a composer cannot move others unless he himself is moved. Yes, that is true, but he doesn't have to be moved at the moment he writes the thing down. He may be moved in a kind of abstract way himself, but in order to write it down, he's got to be cool as marble in order to have it say what he wants it to say. And then he hopes that it will do something to you. To see an audience sitting perfectly still during the Beethoven 7th symphony is one of the most upsetting experiences a musician can have. They're supposed to be hanging onto their seats, not to join the wild dance. But this is just, it's just incredible. So where you see it among the ones who are musical, who are with it all the way, physically as well as mentally and aesthetically, yes, you're absolutely right. It goes directly to the solar plexus. And the good composer will know how to do that. This is not faking, this is not magic, this is not hocus pocus. But the composer must know what effect he wishes to produce on the listener. Not that he pulls strings on the listener's emotions, but he knows what the symbols, the musical symbols are, which will have a certain effect on an intelligent, sophisticated audience. There's nothing you can do with those who are not. Another question is there. Well, we are all talked out, I think.
This way.